Welcome to AmiSites, a podcast that offers you access to thought leaders who can help you expand your entrepreneurial toolbox. Learn from seasoned entrepreneurs who have already walked in your shoes and can help you with your day-to-day business decisions. Join the founder and CEO of Multifunding, Ami Kassar, and his co-host, Lynn Ozer, the president of Multifunding, aka the SBA Queen, as they help you navigate, grow, and stay in control of your business.
Welcome to the next edition of AmiSites. I'm Ami Kassar, your host, and what a treat I have for you today. I've got two queens with me. Ready? I've got my co-host, Lynn Ozer, aka SBA Queen, and I've got my dear friend, Deb Gabor, aka Branding Queen. And so now we've got the SBA queen and the branding queen, and I'm in the middle, and I'm not sure I'm going to get a word in, but that's okay. Welcome to the show. Deb has been a friend for many years, a deep expert in branding, and a special focus these days all about how building personal branding, and I might get this wrong, and really...
I can tell you right now, you're already getting it wrong.
That's not a surprise. Deb, what are we talking about today?
We're going to talk about authority, which authority is sort of like the idea of personal branding on steroids. But I want to talk about authority and how it's different than personal branding, and also how to create authority, establish a footprint of authority, why it's important, and then most important, how to monetize that authority. So those are the things that I want to talk about.
Oh, awesome. It sounds all good to us.
Yeah. Deb sent the agenda for us. We love it. Deb, why don't we start before we dig into all that interesting stuff? And tell us about you.
All right. Well, I like to tell people that I'm in the business of creating the condition that I call irrational loyalty. And irrational loyalty is when people are so indelibly bonded to a brand, they feel like they were cheating on it if they were to choose an alternative. It's how I feel about my iPhone and all of my other iThingies, to the point that if somebody texts me and I see one of those green Android text bubbles, it makes me twitchy, right? And that's where all the margin is. That's where all the growth is. Irrational loyalty, we recently did a study and we looked at the 50 most valuable global brands in the world, and we compared brands against each other in the same categories. And here's what we learned. Brands that create that condition of irrational loyalty, they scale more rapidly, more profitably, more focused. But the most important thing is that they earn on average, and this is just a mean, they earn on average 40% more revenue than companies that don't. So brands create that condition where people are so bonded to the brand that the brand is irreplaceable to them, that it's absolutely indispensable and it's part of who they are. Those brands just are bigger brands, bigger companies. And those brands are worth more. So this is a very important concept. It doesn't matter whether you're a ginormous brand like Apple, Amazon, Microsoft, one of those kinds of brands, or you're a mid-sized business or even a small business. And it doesn't matter if you serve consumers or other businesses, you're a high-end brand, you're a low-end brand, that condition of irrational loyalty exists for everyone. Yes. So that's about me. Yeah.
Okay, but let's go. We're going to peel back the onion just a little bit on you, Deb Gabor, before we dig into that.
Oh, how did you
get into all, this stuff? How did you figure it out? Why does it make you tick? Why do you like it? Tell us your story. Come on.
Okay, so my story is really interesting. I basically grew up in a completely brandless existence. Maybe my story is a little bit similar to yours. I'm first generation born American. My parents are from Hungary. My grandparents and parents, Holocaust survivors, also survivors of the Hungarian Revolution, refugees came to the United States in the late 1950s. Basically with nothing but the clothes on their back, right? And they were sort of pull yourself up by your bootstraps kind of people, got to work, you know, rolled up their sleeves, did not just the best they could, but whatever it took. And as a result, I grew up kind of in this brandless existence. My parents were, they're Eastern Europeans, right? They were very practical, very down to earth. So when everyone else was playing with Barbie, I was playing with dolls that were called Bobby. One of the toys that all of the girls had when I was younger, and maybe Lynn, you remember this, but a very popular toy was like, it was like this Barbie head, and it had like a platform, and the head was like the size of a human head. And it had all this hair, like you could style the hair, and it had like Barbie makeup and stuff, and you could do it up. Do you remember this toy? I wanted this thing.
I had a Barbie.
You had Barbie? Yeah. I wanted this thing so badly. And for Hanukkah one year, I asked for it and I was like, I don't care if I get anything else. 8 days of Hanukkah, I just want this one thing. My parents bought me something similar, but it was just enough off that it was creepy. Her name was Bobby. She had dark hair. And instead of having like this nice platform underneath, she had a suction cup on the bottom. You literally took the head and you like suctioned it to the table. So anyway, I grew up in a brandless existence. When I turned 16 years old, I got my driver's license. The very first thing I did was I drove myself to McDonald's and I had my very first McDonald's meal, which was a fillet of fish. Like a McDonald's hamburger has never crossed my lips for a variety of reasons. But I've always been obsessed with brands, probably because they were scarce to me. Right. And as an adult, when I went out into the world and I started working, like the fascination of these brand relationships, like, why is it possible that a $3,000 pair of shoes can exist? Like, I really wanted to understand the psychology and the behavioral aspects behind that. And so, yeah, I mean, that's my background. That's how I got into it. I grew up in technology. I started out my career in the most brandless place you can imagine, and the highest tech place. I worked at Bell Labs. I was the only woman. I was the youngest person there, and I was the sole marketing person when I started out my career. So it just like, it started from there, like really from this idea that it was something that was taboo to me. And then I became obsessed with it.
So you worked at Bell Labs and was not in technology. It was in branding. So where did you go after you left Bell Labs?
After I left Bell Labs, I did a bunch of different rotations inside of AT&T. I was part of a leadership development program where literally you got a new job every year. So I did everything from like marketing to labor relations. I actually worked for the bargaining agent on the management side of a CWA contract, which was very exciting and sort of made me feel like, oh, maybe I want to go to law school and study labor law. And then the bloom came off that rose pretty quickly. But I did a bunch of different rotations. And one of my bosses when I was working at AT&T was Carly Fiorina. And you have to be of a certain age and have, you know, have some memory of that. But I worked for Carly Fiorina through the divestiture of AT&T, where we spun off Lucent Technologies and NCR and Agilent and all of that. And so that was really exciting because I was on what was called her executive associate team. So I just did like incredible special projects and I got to know her through that, which was pretty cool. Then I went to work for a tech startup, which this shows my age, was called US Robotics. US Robotics was the first company to make a consumer modem. It was the company that is credited with getting human beings, consumers on the internet, right? And so the first modem product that I worked on literally was a coupling device where you took, remember the receiver of the old wireline phone, and you would like put it in a coupler and it would send a tone. That was like the modem device that I worked on. And then I worked on some like really incredible 128K ISDN technology. And so, yeah, I worked in technology companies for several years and then had an opportunity to go to the agency side of the business in the technology industry, relocated to Austin for a really cool job, like went on a job interview to Austin, Texas, on a boondoggle to see my brother who was getting his PhD at the University of Texas. Turns out I loved it there. Love the job, love the company. And so I moved there, worked at a couple of agencies, and then started my own business. My business is an adult now. We are going to celebrate in April our 21st birthday. So we can throw down some booze as a company. Yeah. So yeah, that's my story.
Congratulations. That's looking for, great. Ami?
Yeah. Thank
What's
you.
The decision about starting your own business? And what was that all about? Why'd you do it?
Oh, okay. People always ask me, they're like, how did you become an entrepreneur? I'm an entrepreneur by default, mostly because I make a really shitty employee. I have trouble with authority unless it's me. Ami knows this about me, right? No, actually, it's a really good story of how I ended up starting my own business. So I had a very, very, very bad marriage and a small kid. And my ex-husband was the kind of guy who was A, incapacitated by alcoholism and drug abuse, and B, just sort of like an absentee post-divorce. And so I was saddled with the responsibility not only for taking care of myself, but also taking care of my child, who was 4 years old at the time. Taking care of her, I needed financial security. I needed stability. I needed freedom and the ability to be able to schedule my own world, right? And a lot of people think that it's crazy that I left this very lucrative six-figure job, fancy title, you know, like I worked in a building with gold toilet seats, that kind of stuff and whatever, that I left what other people perceived to be a very stable environment to start my own thing. But I did it really out of a need for preservation and to care for my child. And, you know, with not even 2 cents to rub together, I stole a couple of clients from my previous agency and I started up a thing. And the rest is, as they say, history. So entrepreneurship for me represented freedom. It represented stability, all the things that people who are not entrepreneurs, like things that they don't realize. It really gave me some control over my destiny.
That's terrific.
Tell us how the agency has evolved over the years, because like, where did you start and where are you today?
So where I started was doing the worst freaking job in the world, but it paid good money at the time. Where it started, I just went straight into technology, public relations. So media relations, analyst relations. That was a business that I had come from. I ran somebody else's business doing that. I had great reputation and relationships with the press. And so I started that up. I saw quickly that that industry was going to disappear, because we saw media going through a lot of fragmentation and also consolidation. We saw just sort of like this really fast growth of the internet and blogging and other types of influencers. And I work exclusively with like B2B technology and professional services companies. So I like businesses that serve other businesses. Like that industry was evolving. And I saw that PR was going to get disintermediated. And my background was in quantitative research and brand consulting. I just needed something that was going to pay the bills. And I took these two clients who had defected from the previous agency, took them with me, started that thing up. I hired some people to like take over those accounts. And then I started doing hands-on brand consulting, like really helping businesses go through the process of figuring out their unique role and relevance to their most important clients. And there very quickly was like a huge need for what I was doing. So I spun off all the PR stuff and just the people who I had hired who were doing that stuff. I gave them those clients. I had like built enough revenue that I was able to like focus on where my passion was and frankly, my zone of genius. And so over the years, really, we've gone through some interesting iterations. Services businesses, I like, seem to reinvent themselves over and over again. And, you know, started out doing technology PR. Then I was doing almost like fractional chief marketing officer work, where one of my first assignments in branding was at a consumer packaged goods company, where I filled in for their head of marketing while she was on an extended maternity leave. And her goal for my presence there was to train all of what were product managers, turn them into brand managers and turn them from a product focused company to a brand focused company. I did some of that for a while. And then I started picking up more clients who like wanted that hands-on brand consulting. So we became a brand consulting agency with a research focus, with like a very, very sort of like strategy, research-led branding kind of thing. There was a time, like over the pandemic, my company got really big and we brought digital marketing in-house. We brought a bunch of creative in-house. Turns out like those are commoditized businesses that I think the internet as we know it and search is going to go away. So a lot of the digital marketing things that I had brought in-house are going to be obsolete in a couple of years anyway. So we are focused now exclusively on deep, deep, deep insights-led brand consulting, like coming in and transforming brand positioning and helping organizations with their go-to-market strategy. So almost going back to the core of what we did. So lots of twists and turns, got big, got small, got big, got small. Now we're on the smaller side now and far more profitable because it's not about what you make, it's what you keep, right?
You know what? That is so funny that you said that because so many times in my background, you hear people, I want to hit 2 million. I want to hit 5 million top line, 10 million. You could have a huge top line. Your bottom line could be nothing. And I think you're so right. But back to what you had said at the very beginning, what is driving you and what is it that you want other people on this podcast to know about your business or you want to share that perhaps they're missing in their business?
Yeah, I think irrational loyalty is the thing that I really want to share and the idea that this condition can exist. So irrational loyalty is the thing that makes customers not defect. Irrational loyalty is the condition or the feeling or the relationship that people have with your brand that helps you continue your business even when you screw something up. Right. My second book is called Irrational Loyalty, Building a Brand That Thrives in Turbulent Times. Like that condition where people are so dedicated to you is the thing that sustains businesses through difficult times. We saw this through the pandemic. We see this like brands have missteps all the time. Somehow I became the world's resident authority on botched corporate apologies and brand disasters. And so like I study brand disasters. There are some brands who really, really screw up and then, you know, they reemerge stronger than they ever were. There are other brands that screw up. They shoot themselves in the foot. Sometimes we forget about it, but often we don't. And then those brands end up in the brand graveyard. And so the thing that I want people to take away from this is this notion that this brand relationship is something that exists for any kind of business, no matter the size or the scope. And that is something that you can create. The other takeaway is that as the leader of a business, a lot of us are very, very purpose-driven. Like our reason for starting a business, it might be you want to create a change in the world and you want to have an impact, or that impact that you're looking for is you want to create a better life for your family, right? And in order to create that kind of change, you can use your own authority as the living, breathing, walking billboard for your company, with your company as a platform for that, or, you know, for you as an individual, like if you want to create change in your church or in the school district, or as, you know, as Ami has by providing this content as a great service to his community. And I have a surprise for Ami. In this book, did you ever read this book?
Maybe.
Did you read it? You can tell me no, it's okay.
Honestly, I haven't read it yet. I was waiting for a surprise.
Okay. So the surprise is that I wrote about Ami in this book. And so this book is called Personality: Cultivate Your Human Authority to Ignite Irrational Brand Loyalty. This is about branding for leaders. And there's a whole section of this book, like a bonus chapter that is called E2E Marketing, which is entrepreneur to entrepreneur marketing. And while Ami wasn't the inspiration for this book, what Ami does is the very definition of authority. And so I wrote about him. And can I read to you this passage, Ami?
Please read it to me if he doesn't want to hear it.
All right. Ami Kassar is the author of the best-selling book, The Growth Dilemma. He established a thought leadership platform focused on connecting entrepreneurs with loans and funding that will help their businesses grow. Ami poses these questions to entrepreneurs. What if I gave you $1 million and you could only invest in your business? How would you use the money? In which part of your business would you invest? After getting entrepreneurs to contemplate how an investment could help their businesses, Ami shows them how and where they can get the capital via SBA loans and other sources. When the pandemic hit, the government began offering PPP loans and economic injury disaster loans, the EIDL. And because Ami had built a good deal of authority in the field of small business loans, folks came running to him for advice. Do you remember this? Of course, there was no money in PPP loans, which were available through banks at only 1% interest. The EIDLs, meanwhile, were offered directly from the SBA. There was simply no way for an independent loan advisor to make any money from either of these two programs. Ami didn't stand to make a single cent. But he lent his expertise to others in their time of need. He knew that entrepreneurs were nervous and confused at that time, and they needed his steady leadership to guide them through the latest information on both programs. Every single day, Ami reported the latest news to his growing audience. When the government would release a new set of guidelines or program rules, Ami would stay up all night studying the documents so he could summarize and interpret the information to entrepreneurs all over the country the very next day. He became the center of an entrepreneurial community's PPP and EIDL universe, and he still had no money to make from his advice. But he knew he was cultivating and engaging a community, and he knew it was a good thing. He even reached a point where his community was growing so rapidly that he had to migrate to a different platform on a third-party application. He created a membership community where he could post updates and the members could comment and interact with each other. In one of the scariest times for small business, that community became vital to a growing number of entrepreneurs. Before long, Inc. magazine recognized how important that community was and invited Ami, along with his entire membership, to move to the Inc.com platform. When Ami moved over to a platform with a much broader reach, his advice began to connect with a whole new audience of entrepreneurs. He became a household name with a larger population. Now that post-pandemic business is easing back towards a new normal, Ami is once again returning to his loan advising business. But now, because of the authority he's built by helping other entrepreneurs, the demand for his services has skyrocketed. He's hired new team members. He's built new assets. He's written a new book. He's moved into a nicer, newer office. And it was all made possible by entrepreneur to entrepreneur marketing.
Wow. That's beautiful tribute.
I convinced the SBA queen to join my team. But let's dig into that a little bit. Can we dig into that a little bit?
Absolutely. Yes.
What do you think of the word servant leadership?
Servant leadership very much is about creating authority. Like authority and servant leadership are indelibly linked, right? So servant leadership and authority, as I define authority, are basically the same thing. It means serving people and giving to them without any expectation of anything in return. It means doing it from an authentic, sincere place in your heart with the idea that all you want to do is help other people. So at the beginning of the pandemic, I was working on another book, and that book was all about AI. It was called Why AI Can't Solve AI's Marketing Problem. I had two panels, unheard of, two panels at South by Southwest to talk about this topic. And I was really excited to like introduce this new content. Well, we know South by Southwest was one of the first things to get canceled in 2020. And then my entire speaking platform was like taken away from me, like it was taken away from Ami, right? And then I was faced with this notion of going back to work, so to speak. So I show up at my company on Zoom and I was like, guys, I'm here. And they were like, get out, get out, get out, Deb Gabor. We don't want you here. We've worked too hard to create a business that runs without you. Do not come back here. And I was like, what am I going to use my time doing? So I really thought about it. I was like, what do people need? What do people need? And Ami and I both did this, which was, I said, I have expertise that's going to help people navigate through this very difficult time. And that specific expertise really was helping them connect with their audiences, connect with their customers during a time where they couldn't be with them. In some cases, people were like, you know, locking down budgets. They were, you know, it just, the world of marketing changed in an instant. And I thought, I can help people without asking for anything in return. And so I went to the internet. We had a series, like before Ami had Aminars or whatever, I had Debinars, right?
Are you going to clear, are we?
Yeah, yeah. So you know, we were doing this and I wasn't looking for anything in return. And what was very surprising about that experience was like 6 months down the road, people weren't coming to my company for B2B technology and professional services, like strategy, research, and marketing services. People were leaning forward and telling me what they wanted from me, which was they wanted to learn how to become me. They wanted to learn how to become me. They wanted to learn how to become Ami. They wanted to learn how to become people who can cultivate community through giving, right? And so, you know, as a result, I continue to share this information, right? You know, I put this out there to the world. I share my expertise for free. I just spent a week, Utah Tech Week last week. I had like three different speaking events where at the end, I like show a QR code. I'm like, download all this free shit. You don't even have to give me an email address. I'm not going to market to you. I'm on a million brand mission and I just want you to have this. And as a result, I've grown as a human. I've cultivated this incredible community. I continue to give to them, and then they lean forward and tell me what they want me to buy from them or what they want to buy from me, right? And so servant leadership, Ami, is serving without asking for anything in return. It truly is this like no expectation of reciprocity. The reciprocity, which is true, it's a psychological condition, reciprocity. The reciprocity happens naturally and authentically when you just give to an audience. So I tell people, you're not ready to be an authority until you are ready to just give it away for free with the sole purpose of helping other people and uplifting them. You can't be an authority without that. Does that make sense?
It's interesting because, look, we obviously during the PPP and the EIDL time put in a ton of effort and a ton of sweat and a ton of blood and didn't try to monetize it for a penny.
Nope.
And I knew in the back of my head that I was helping to build our brand and our authority.
100%.
But I would have done it if I wasn't.
You would have done it anyway. Yeah. So that's the notion of authority is like, I would have done it anyway. Right. And there are people out there who are like accidental authorities, people who don't want to be authorities. Like there's a whole chapter in this book about accidental authorities. I think of Joe Rogan as one of those people. He's like, people take what I have to say on my podcast as gospel. He's like, most of the time, I don't know what I'm talking about. If they want to take that advice and they want to credit me with that authority, that's their fault. That's their problem. I never set out to do this. But then there are people who are intentional authorities. And then there are people who sort of stumble into it because they have a sincere and authentic desire to create some kind of goodness in their world, whether that's like, you know, in their own backyard, down the street, around the corner, or halfway across the world.
It's interesting because, and for me, it's just my own personal shtick. Of course, I want to have a good business and make money and feed my family and go on vacation and pay kids' college tuition and save money and keep my wife happy and all that stuff. But ultimately, my primary driver is I just care about people and I love helping entrepreneurs.
Yeah, and that's absolutely the truth. You know, Ami, like you and I have known each other for a long time. I've been following you around this world and you are one of the good ones and you're one of the helpers. You know, I look at things, an example is like the Entrepreneurs Organization, the group that you started back in early October to stimulate discussions about what was happening in Israel that was out of service to other humans. Like what you did during the pandemic. Like I said, you didn't stand to make a penny on PPP loans or EIDL loans, but you really wanted to help people. And that's a sincere, authentic form of authority. I know your business has bloomed and continues to grow and continues to be successful. That footprint of authority, which may or may not be directly related to your business, it is part of that. People are attracted to you. You are the walking, living, breathing billboard for your brand, right? And there's a very strong attraction. Your brand is a magnet, right? And it's designed to attract to you people who share your values and beliefs, right? It's a very human relationship.
And I appreciate that. And I'll try to stop blushing for a minute. But I also think I'm really lucky because I stumbled upon, or I decided, or maybe it wasn't an accident, a business that was really driven around my passion and my values where I could do these things. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if I would have survived if I started a business. I mean, brutal difficult. I don't know if I would have survived starting a business manufacturing shoelaces or widgets or something.
Yeah. I always say like I would have sucked in the brewery business or if I were, you know, if I were making clothing or that. I mean, I have the business I have because it ignites my passion around brands, right? And that is part of authority, is having something that you are compelled to share and compelled to do. And you know that other people will benefit as a result of it. There are many, many CEOs out there in the world who are not authorities. Like if I ask you right now, who's the founder of Salesforce? Mark Benioff, top of mind. Who's the founder of Zoho? Nobody knows, right? Who's the founder of Tesla? Elon Musk. Who's the founder of Toyota? Nobody knows, right? There are lots of people out there walking around this world who are not using their company or their brand awareness as a platform or something that builds the footprint of authority because they're not driven to do it. People like Benioff and Salesforce, he's actually trying to stimulate change. He's not just trying to sell sales CRM software and marketing cloud. He's trying to create a difference in the way that people work and relate to each other and to customers and relationships and things like that. Not everyone wants to be an authority. Not everybody has what it takes to be an authority. And you can look across different industries and you can see where people have consciously or unconsciously chosen to like use their platform of awareness, their company, their reach, and things like that to create change in the world. And in some cases, you know, the company creates that platform and the individual person steps forward. But not everybody wants to be an authority. Not everybody can be an authority, right? Some people are naturally an authority. I was looking for the passage in this book where I talk about, you know, when are you ready to be an authority? And basically what it says is, you know, first of all, you have to have something that you're compelled to share. Secondly, you have to want to share that from a place that is really just about helping other people. Thirdly, you can let shit roll off your back because you're willing to invite the slings and arrows of critics, right? And then like the next five things on the list is you are willing to give, 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 and just like give things away for free, right? And so Ami, you're an example of that. That's what I've been doing. I've been doing it for years. It monetizes. It brings people to my company. It sells books. It hires me for speaking engagements. I have online courses and masterclasses and coaching and all of that kind of stuff and whatever. But I couldn't just put all that stuff out to the world without already having a footprint of authority and a reason for people to want to come to me.
Fascinating.
People to realize that this isn't for everybody.
Mm-mm.
Right? And
right.
I think we make that mistake. I see it a lot in even in forums or in EO or different thing where people say, well, that worked for somebody, so it's got to work for my business. Or no. That business used that vendor, so I need to use that vendor.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone's in a lane. I think there are some businesses or types of businesses where this authority marketing is spot on and mm-hmm. the CEO, or the founder, and the owner can really use the platform to leverage that.
Yep.
I'm very fortunate to have found a business that I can do that. I don't know if I would want to be in my own business if I couldn't do that, but that's me and my own DNA.
Yep.
But that doesn't mean that someone couldn't build a highly successful shoe business that doesn't have authority marketing, and that's okay.
Well, I mean, here's a very highly successful shoe business. Nike, Phil Knight, the founder of Nike, has established a really solid platform of authority. Not because he wanted to be an authority, but he earned authority from creating this like incredible global brand, right? So it works in both directions. So here's what I would say. You know, people often come to me and they ask me, they're like, oh, there's some kind of dust up going on right now out there, a social issue, a political issue, you know, some kind of controversial thing. I feel like I need to say something. I never tell them yes or no. What we do is go through a process and try to understand, A, who is your ideal customer? Like who is the human being who is most highly predictive of your success? What are their expectations of you as an individual? What are their expectations of you as a brand? Do you really need to have a dog in this hunt? B, is this important to you as a human being? And how much do you want to use the platform of your company and its customers and its investors, its partners, its community, its employees to take a stand on that, right? You have to kind of go through this process. And I tell people all the time, just because you can doesn't mean you should, right? There's a whole bunch of context there. An authority is sort of the lens that you look at that through, right? You know, people are like, oh, there's this big thing going on right now. Over the summer, it was Dylan Mulvaney and Bud Light and like one Instagram post and a six pack of Bud Light beer, if you guys remember this. And there were people coming to me and they're like, should I say something about this? I'm like, are you Dylan Mulvaney or Bud Light? You know, like what? how important is this to you? How important is this to your customers? What is the strategy through which you are viewing this as appropriate or not appropriate, right? And so all of these decisions, they can't be taken lightly. And authority and really understanding, what am I compelled to share? Who am I sharing that with? What is my purpose in doing this? What are the expectations that other people have of me? To what extent am I willing to put my own brand and my company's brand at risk? Like, what are the potential rewards? Like, Ami is a very outspoken person. And Ami, it is 100% on brand for you to take a stand on a lot of social issues. I've come to expect that from you, but I'm very aligned with your values and beliefs, right? Because your brand attracts people who are purpose mission driven and people who inside themselves are very principled and have very strong values and beliefs and probably have a strong sense of social justice, right? Does that make sense what I'm saying?
Something makes sense. Who are your target clients?
Who are my target clients? My target audience, well, let me tell you who my ideal customer is. My ideal customer is actually based on a real human being, and her name is Lindsay, and she is the chief marketing officer of the mid-market division at SAP now. She is so irrationally loyal to my brand that she would stake her professional reputation on hiring us. I have worked with her at 5 different companies over the last 21 years. She's kind of grown up with the company, but what makes her my ideal customer is that she is an innovative, thoughtful, marketing-driven leader who is in growth mode. She has a grow-or-die mindset. She is a person who is very much about working with someone who is not going to just do the best they can, but whatever it takes to hit goals. She's not rewarding and not looking to pay for the process. It really is results that she's looking for. So how that translates into the kinds of clients I'm looking for, B2B technology or professional services or companies that have a technology-enabled value proposition. So somehow you deliver your brand promise through technology or you provide services to other businesses. That's basically it. I'm looking for thoughtful, strategic leaders who are in growth mode. They are looking to really disrupt. They're looking to go from being a dark horse to being a most valuable global brand. They're super innovative. They themselves have a platform of authority within their organization, or they're the leader of their organization. Mid-market on up. I'm really, really, really passionate about mid-market companies. Even though we work with household name brands in the technology industry, you know, top 50 most valuable global brands, like my real passion is in the mid-market, and that's where we can make the most difference.
Mid-market means different things to different people. What does it mean to you?
To me, these are companies, mid-market to me are like 100 to about 1,000 employees. These are revenues of, you know, typically about $30 to $500 million. That's kind of the mid-market in the technology industry. I do work with smaller companies and, you know, everything we do is strategy-led and there's always an aspect of discovery and research we do, you know, and I have some lower cost services for earlier stage companies or smaller companies, but like our core really is that mid-market.
How do people find you? That's our question.
How do people find me? Well, I'm all over the internet. You can just do a search on Deb Gabor. I'm all over for good things and bad, mostly. But you can go to debgabor.com. There's information about all my books. There's a bunch of videos. There's free resources to download. You can book time with me. I will talk to anybody about their brand. So book a time with me. That's probably the best way to get in touch with me. Also, my company is called Soul Marketing, Soul like the sun in Spanish, and soulmarketing.com. If you want to read about the cool work that we do with B2B technology and professional services companies, there's information there. But those are the best ways to reach out to me, debgabor.com or soulmarketing.com. I'm also on all the social media platforms. I barely use Facebook anymore. Really, my platform of choice is LinkedIn. I'm Deb Gabor on LinkedIn. I post most of my stuff there, and you can find out where I'm speaking and doing workshops and when I'm launching new content and stuff like that. So those are all the best ways to find me. Ami also has a direct line to me. He texts me often on weekends and on late nights to gossip.
Brand of faith to try and make her laugh, and usually I'm successful.
He's successful. There have been moments where I was like, Ami, we can't have this conversation anymore. Right.
It was so nice to meet you and great to listen to you.
Yeah, so nice to meet you.
Fascinating. Thanks for joining us.
So much, Deb. It's always a treat. Keep smiling. I'm glad you're feeling better, and I'm looking forward to seeing you in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, see you in a couple of weeks. Nice to meet you, Lynn. You guys take care.
Nice to meet you.
Thanks for joining us today on OmniSites. Since 2010, multifunding has helped businesses achieve their biggest growth goals through creative and personalized funding solutions, working with a network of the nation's top lenders. Visit us at multifunding.com, where you can meet our advisory team and learn more about how we help entrepreneurs fund their future.